This is UBS's Top of the Morning. Opportunity zones are emerging for investors and offer both potential and challenge. We will cover what exactly opportunity zones are, where they can be found, how to invest in them, and more. It is Tuesday, February 5th, 2019. I'm Dan Cassidy. Welcome and thank you for joining us today. I would like to welcome my guest back to the program, Head of Sustainable and Impact Investing Americas from the UBS Chief Investment Office, Andrew Lee. So, Andrew, good morning. Welcome back. And thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Dan.
So, Andrew, can you begin by providing us with an overview of what opportunity zones exactly are?
Sure. So the Tax Reform Act that was enacted in December 2017, among other changes, included a tax incentive for investors who are interested in taking their accumulated capital gains and reinvesting for the long term into distressed areas around the country. So you asked, what are opportunity zones? They're actually the 8,700 plus individual census tracts that have been officially designated by the Treasury, where someone can invest and get these tax benefits. They're located in every state, some in some expected places and some perhaps less so. You know, if you think about them, they are about 13% rural. The rest are generally urban, densely populated areas with populations of 50,000 people or more. Unemployment rate on average is about 13%, which compares to 8% nationwide for the same data period. If we compare that to current unemployment that we observe now, it's 3%. So higher unemployment on average, poverty rates similarly are 32%, about double the national average. And median family income, it's about two-thirds of area median income as opposed to the national average, which is pretty close to actual area median income. So you can see that they do exhibit signs of stress. You know, one example is the Bronx in New York, where you certainly see those unemployment, poverty rate, and median family income stressed versus the national average. So, you know, there's opportunity and risk in what I just mentioned. On the one hand, you know, if you look at it from an investment perspective, there's a lot of potential upside if you're developing these areas. If you take the long-term view, that infrastructure will come in, community will develop, and, you know, costs will look low a decade from now. But there's also clearly risk that's associated with investing in development projects in areas that, you know, are up and coming or are experiencing distress for any number of reasons. And it will differ by census tract. So, you know, I think for us, it really emphasizes the importance, and we'll dig into a little bit of the investments later, I think, but you really need to find the right partners that you're investing with who recognize the risks, they're long-term oriented, and they're really thinking about how these assets land in the community.
And it sounds like, Andrew, based on the credentials you just walked us through, these opportunity zones are likely to be found all over the country. And I also want to highlight that we are discussing an education note that you have up on UBS Online Services on this topic, opportunity zones, great potential challenges. So maybe let's dig a bit deeper first into the potential that's available for investors.
Sure. Pretty simply, there's potential tax benefit for investors from this incentive. It can be extremely helpful to many investors who have accumulated capital gains just from being in the equity markets for the past decades, or perhaps people who have concentrated stock positions from their companies, maybe entrepreneurs who are selling their companies. Any one of these investors who have capital gains across a wide range of assets can benefit from this tax incentive. So if we break it down, there are three basic distinct tax advantages that you can get by investing in opportunity zones. The first is deferral. So where you as an investor otherwise would have recognized a capital gain today and paid taxes on it, you can defer payment of that tax until at a maximum the end of the year 2026. So there's time value of money in you know, having the cash and not paying the tax until then, certainly. The second benefit is a reduction in tax on the original gain. So if you as an investor hold that investment, you know, rolling over the capital gains into an investment in these qualified opportunity zones, and you hold it for at least 5 years, you get a step up in basis to 10% of that gain. So where going in, you invested that capital and you had a zero basis, your basis steps up to 10% of the gain. And if you hold for 7 years in total, there's a step up in basis of 15%. So max overall, you could reduce your overall tax bill when you pay it in 2026 or earlier if you sell it by 15%. And the third benefit is that you really eliminate tax on any future appreciation of that opportunity zone investment as long as you hold it for 10 or more years. So mathematically, we think that that works out to the most advantageous element. Again, if you're looking at investments that actually generate an economic return on top of the tax incentive. And that's really the way that we think people have to look at it. So the three tax benefits, those are really the things that investors can benefit from.
Now, what about the challenges?
Sure. There are lots of challenges. I think I mentioned previously the risk of investing in these distressed economic areas. It's not an insignificant risk that people have to consider. Generally speaking, a lot of the emphasis is going to be on real estate development in these areas. And real estate development is not without its risks, especially at this point in the cycle. So people have to think about that. We talked about 10 plus years, so there's a long hold period that's required in order to realize the maximum benefit of the tax exclusion. So you have to be prepared to accept illiquidity. And I mentioned that, you know, deferred tax you have to pay by the end of 2026 at the latest. So, you know, as an investor, you have to make sure that you reserve some liquidity to pay that tax bill, especially if you're going to hold the underlying investment for 10 or more years. So, you know, it's a litany of things. And I just want to make sure that people recognize this is not a straightforward investment. But the last thing that I'd mention is, investors, some of our investors might be focused on not only for just the tax benefits, but also because they're interested in seeing positive improvement in these opportunity zones from a social impact perspective, right? And ultimately, that was actually the original impetus behind developing opportunity zones as a piece of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act in 2017. So there isn't anything in the current statute or regulations that require reporting or making sure that these investments do good for the community. But we do think that responsible fund managers and investors who look for returns are also going to force some accountability on their own. And so they're looking at it from the perspective of not necessarily hurting returns, but actually enhancing them if they think about the impact perspective and how an investment fits into the overall community. These are long-term assets that they're developing and holding. So thinking about how they fit in is an important thing. And we think it goes to returns too.
Okay, so clearly benefits, but also challenges for investors as it pertains to opportunity zones. Within the education note, Andrew, I noticed that there is a comprehensive investment example that you have outlined for us. What can you share with us there?
Sure, and I won't go through it in all detail, but let's say an investor today, we've named her Helen, has a capital gain of $9 million, which she ends up realizing and reinvesting into an opportunity zone fund. So where she would have had to pay $2.1 million of taxes today, assuming a 23.8% tax rate, she can end up deferring that until the 2026 tax year. So she now has a $9 million investment in a qualified opportunity fund with a zero basis, but she has not paid tax on that she otherwise would have. Once she holds it for 5 years, her basis in that qualified opportunity fund is 10% of the original gain. So it was a $9 million original gain. Now she has a $900,000 basis in that. And if she sold at that point, then she would pay a reduced tax by 10%. If she holds that for 7 years, her basis increases by another 5%, so a total 15% basis step up for $1.35 million basis. So if she sold at that point, then she is selling or she's paying tax on a reduced on 85% of the original gain. She will have to pay the tax in 2026, as we mentioned, but it's 15% less than what she would have paid in 2019 or today. But our assumption is that she still holds the fund realize the tax exclusion on any appreciation. So as long as she owns it past the year 2029 or for more than 10 years, whenever she then sells her qualified opportunity fund investment thereafter, it steps up to fair market value, and therefore she doesn't pay any tax on that basis. So that's a quick illustration. Feel free to see our note for more details as to how the mechanics actually work. But that's the example.
Okay, so say I'm a UBS client, Andrew, I'm listening in, I'm interested in investing in opportunity zones. How exactly does that work?
Sure. So you're really asking, what are you investing in? And I mentioned that the only way to invest in these opportunity zones and get the tax benefits is really to invest through a vehicle called the Qualified Opportunity Fund. It's not that difficult to set one up. You can actually just self-certify that you are, so there's no actual application process. The Treasury is not approving you or disapproving you, but you're applying on your own to be a Qualified Opportunity Fund. There are restrictions, though, on what these funds can actually invest in. So the way that the law is currently written, it supports investments primarily in property, perhaps businesses at a later stage, which is what we think really stimulates economic development in an area, but primarily it's property. So technically speaking, what these qualified opportunity funds can own is either business property, where the original use has to start with the fund. They have to have acquired it after the end of 2017. And you have to substantially improve that property, which really means you put in dollar amount to improve the property that's equivalent to the basis of the property itself, excluding land. So that's one type of thing that you can own. The other type of thing you can own, broadly speaking, is investments in an opportunity zone business. So you can either own that through stock or partnership interests. Again, you have to have acquired these in 2018, and these have to be qualified opportunity zone businesses. So they can own qualified opportunity zone property. There are restrictions around how much of the business's gross income has to be derived from the particular area. And they're prohibited from engaging in certain activities like gambling and the like. So those are the two types of things that qualified opportunity funds can invest in. And again, we think that it's primarily going to focus on property initially. There are some additional restrictions, but I won't go into those here. Feel free to read the note.
Yeah, of course, if we do have UBS clients listening in, if they are interested in learning more about how to invest in opportunity zones, of course, reference the note available up on UBS Online Services, but also have a conversation with your financial advisor as well. We strongly encourage that. So before we wrap up our conversation today, Andrew, can you speak to what we may expect to see as it pertains to opportunity zones throughout 2019?
I'm sure. So we think 2019 is going to be a busy year for opportunity zones. The legislation went into effect at the end of 2017. We now have regulations from Treasury as of October. More are expected, but we think that what's out there enables investment vehicles to actually come to market. And so we think that investors who are looking to maximize those tax benefits that I talked about before, the deferral and the step up, as well as the back end exclusion, will start to put capital to work in 2019 in order to maximize those benefits. We also think that based on what the regulations look like, that single asset funds, so focused on single properties, a fund can obviously own a single property or it can own multiple properties. We think that those will constitute much of the flow in the early days, and that we will see some of these diversified funds come to market as people get more comfortable with regulations. But we do think that those are also coming, that people have been able to structure around those. The difference between a single asset and a diversified asset fund, obviously, is that you get the diversification, whether it's across geography or the asset type or the business type, or just general the asset itself. And so we think that people ought to think about diversification when they're looking at this. But both types we expect to see in 2019. I mentioned expect to see real estate primarily, but businesses perhaps later in the year or maybe in 2020 and beyond. And we also think that we will see additional regulations from Treasury, as I mentioned, which we hope will clarify some of the issues around, for example, whether funds that own multiple properties can sell those properties before the 10 years by another qualified property without invalidating the tax benefits for investors. Again, we don't think that that will prevent existing funds from moving ahead. So we expect to see a number of investment funds start to come to market at scale in the next couple of quarters and for that investment to start to be made. But we think it's an exciting year. We think investors are looking at this for tax reasons. We think that fund managers are looking at this as a way to continue to move capital into these underserved areas. And we think for communities, it's an exciting prospect. But as you mentioned, there are challenges, and I think that we really need to make sure that the majority of the capital that moves is good for investors, generating a real return over long periods of time, And also has benefits for the communities in terms of the assets actually being good assets for communities and contributing to further jobs and economic development. So, you know, as you mentioned, it's we think there's great potential in this incentive, both for investors and communities. But we think there are challenges that are real that need to be addressed. And so anybody that's looking at this, whether from the investment side or the community side, should be thoughtful about how they put their capital to work and who they're working with.
Well, to your point, Andrew, it does sound like a very exciting year ahead as the space continues to develop and grow. So we'll look forward to having you on with us throughout the year to keep us informed on the progress. But do appreciate you joining us this morning to educate us for now on what opportunity zones are, the challenges, the potentials involved as well. But thank you again, Andrew. We look forward to continuing the conversation throughout the year.
Thanks for having me, Dan.
Absolutely. And again, we have been joined by Head of Sustainable and Impact Investing Americas from the UBS Chief Investment Office, Andrew Lee. So there are many public available now up on UBS Online Services, including the education note that we have been referencing during today's podcast. Again, the title is Opportunity Zones, Great Potential, Potential Challenges. So for UBS clients, of course, you can contact your financial advisor if you would like to receive a copy of the education note. Top of the morning, we'll be back again for you tomorrow morning. Have a great day, everyone.